Hello, today is Thursday, the 12th of October 2017. This is the Saturn edition of the St Albans Talking Newspaper. I am Malcolm and I've selected the articles and will be making announcements and taking part in the reading together with Kate, Michael, Alison and Jenny. Jenny also is responsible for copying this recording every month together with Mekki from the Master Take onto the listener sticks. Danny is our studio manager and he's doing the recording and editing, and Fiona organises the distribution. The music is called Blue Skies and is provided by Goffby. The news articles are chosen from today's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Here are the headlines. Gravestones destroyed in disrespectful attack. £550,000 bill for major consultants. Cars damaged after nonsense signs for roadworks. Search continues for car in hit and run tragedy. And here is Kate with the first article.
Hello, I'm Kate, and this article is about gravestones destroyed in a disrespectful attack. Vandals have wreaked a trail of destruction through a council cemetery, kicking over gravestones and smashing memorials. Nine headstones at Westfield Road Cemetery in Harpenden were broken and kicked over on the afternoon of Thursday, October 5th, and St Albans District Council is now trying to locate and inform the plot owners, some of which date back decades. The wreckage was discovered by cemetery staff on Friday morning. Head of Community Services for SADC, Debbie White, said, "This is an appalling crime that is both disrespectful and potentially very upsetting to the relatives of those buried there. The police are investigating and we will, of course, give them every assistance that we can with their inquiries." She said the remaining gravestones have now been made safe and they are searching for affected families to discuss their options. District Councillor for Harpenden North, Bert Poole, added, "I'm saddened that people have got that attitude. It's disrespectful. It obviously happened in the daylight hours before dusk, and we need to ask ourselves what we can do. You can't put up CCTV, it's intrusive, but we need to see what can be done." He believed the graves were from the 1930s and 40s, and the plot owners could therefore be difficult to locate. A spokesperson from Hearts Police said they're investigating the Safer Neighbourhood team, are conducting high visibility controls in and around the cemetery and the surrounding areas. The vandalism comes after a previous incident in 2011 when thieves repeatedly stole flowers from the Westfield Road Cemetery.
Hello, I'm Michael, and the headline for this item is £550,000 bill for major project consultants. The amount spent on consultants and legal experts for two major developments in the district was more than £500,000, it has been revealed. In 2016-2017, £257,610 was spent on hiring consultants to help on the Harpenden Leisure and Culture development. In the same period, £290,868 was spent on consultants and £4,150 was spent on legal experts, both for the new St Albans Museum and Gallery. The consultants on the museum worked on asbestos clearance, exhibition design and archaeology. Consultants were also hired to help with fundraising after the council promised to raise £1.7 million of the museum's £7.7 million budget through charity. On the Harpenden development, consultants were hired for the design charrette, a public meeting where residents could have their say on the plans. Consultants were also tasked with advising on the local plan. St Albans Council's Deputy Chief Executive, Richard Shway, said, "We are undertaking a number of exciting building projects that will be of tremendous benefit to the community. A local authority of our size cannot deliver such complex and challenging projects without the help of a range of external experts." On Harpenden's charrette, he said, "We hired a facilitator to organise the design charrette for the Harpenden Sport and Arts Centre to ensure the process was run independently of the council. That is now an established practice that we also used when drawing up options for the redevelopment of the city centre opportunity site around the Alban Arena." On the consultants hired to help fundraise, Mr. Shui said, when an ambitious £1.7 million fundraising target was set for the new museum, it became clear we needed to recruit a professional dedicated to the task. That has been a highly successful move, with £1.3 million raised so far. We are completely transparent about the use of external advisors, and details of consultancy fees are published on our website. There are also procedures in place to ensure value for money, such as tendering and a scrutiny committee which examines our spending. The council did not comment on the consultants hired to help on the local plan.
Hello, I'm Alison. My first article has the title Cars Damaged After Nonsense Diversion Signs for Roadworks. While Affinity Water carried out work to replace 60-year-old pipes around Sopwell Lane and Watson's Walk, parking spaces were lost, roads were closed and diversion routes signposted. But residents argued because of the unclear signs and roadblocks on only one side, confused motorists were still driving through and then had to turn around or reverse. This was even more difficult than usual because the roads were narrower. Parking was prohibited during the works and displaced cars packed what available spaces were left, leading to many vehicles being damaged. Sopwell Lane resident Harvey Forsyth, 50, found £300 worth of damage had been caused to his car. A neighbour discovered worse, with £4,000 worth of scratches along the length of their vehicle, and another neighbour's brick wall was damaged. Harvey said, "To be honest, we don't really know who did it, but something big came down the road. There are some terrible roads which have to be fixed, but the way it was handled, the way the road was closed off, was pretty poor." On one Friday at midnight, Harvey was shocked to see a big lorry trying to reverse out of the road after becoming caught in the works. He described it as chaos and a free-for-all, where everyone was doing whatever they wanted. St Albans District Councillor Chris White said, "Diversion signs made no sense. They were nonsense, and drivers wouldn't know what to do. People were fed up with the situation, but the problem has been compounded by the damage." He added, "It's also frustrating. Where do you park in the area when the parking spaces you are paying for have gone?" An Affinity Water spokesperson said they were sorry for any inconvenience. "We worked closely with the local authorities to put a road closure with diversions in place to ensure the safety of commuters and our contractors carrying out the improvement works. Advance warning signs advising motorists of the road closure and the diversion were in place on the junction of Keyfield Crescent, Sopwell Lane, and repeated on the junction of Hollywell Hill and Sopwell Lane. The roadworks on Sopwell Lane have now finished."
Hello, I'm Jenny. And this first piece is "Search Continues for Car in Hit-and-Run Tragedy." Tributes have been paid to a woman killed in a hit-and-run in St Albans. Barbara Little, 76, of Camp Road, was crossing the road outside her home on Thursday, September the 28th, on her way to a darts match, when she was hit by a vehicle, which then drove off. Barbara, who was born and bred in the city, leaves a son, Kevin, 48, a son-in-law, Brian, 49, a daughter, Sharon, 46, and grandchildren, Sean, 28, Rianne, 21, Reese, 17, Megan, 12, and 10-month-old granddaughter, Aida. Kevin, who lives in Blackpool, said, "Mum always had her lipstick on and her hair done. She was always well turned out. She looked after herself. She was the best. Sharon and I had such a happy childhood." On her love of darts, he said, "I went to see her play a few times with my dad and I was so proud. We always used to sit at the back out of sight because if she knew we were there, it would make her nervous." Police are still appealing for information on the incident. Detective Inspector Chris Puddy said, "This is a very upsetting case where a woman has lost her life just by going about her daily routine. Her family are being supported and officers are working hard to trace the person responsible. We're particularly interested in speaking to the drivers of a medium-sized, light-coloured car, possibly a BMW, and a small, dark-coloured hatchback. They were seen in the area around the time of the incident and may have information that could be vital to our investigation. We would also like to speak to anyone who was in Camp Road after 8 p.m., in particular any joggers and dog walkers. Did you see a vehicle leaving the scene with damage or driving in an erratic manner? Are you a mechanic or do you work in a garage? Have you repaired any vehicles with damage to their front end since Thursday, September the 28th? If so, we would be very keen to speak to you. To the person who was driving the vehicle involved, you have caused unimaginable pain and suffering to Barbara's family. You cut her life short, and her loved ones now have to live without their mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. I am asking you to do the right thing and hand yourself in.
This next article begins, fresh questions asked about the storage of fuel at Buntsfield, 12 years after the explosion. Confusion clouds claims that petrol is going to be stored at Buntsfield for the first time since the catastrophic explosion in 2005. There are two fuel storage sites adjacent to each other at Buntsfield. The first, Buntsfield, was destroyed 12 years ago. It was rebuilt in a different place and named the West London Pipeline and Storage. It is managed by the British Pipeline Agency, or the BPA, on behalf of the owners, Royal Dutch Shell, BP, Total and Valero. The site exploded when a petrol tank overflowed, creating a blast equivalent to 30 tonnes of TNT and letting out a bang which registered 2.4 on the Richter scale. Nearby residents, including those whose homes were devastated in the explosion, were reassured at the time that petrol in those tankers was banned. But a report on BBC News last week claimed the site could now be used to store the fuel, but conceded there had been no official word from the BPA. BP stored jet fuel at the neighbouring tanker, the Hemel Hempstead Terminal. As recently as 2014, ground fuels like petrol and diesel were also kept there. In June this year, BP submitted a planning application to Decorum Borough Council for the switch to purely ground fuels on the site from 2018. Chairman of Redbourne Parish Council, Councillor David Mitchell, lives 500 metres from Buntsfield and is still haunted by memories of the explosion. He was appalled to hear that more petrol could be stored next to Buntsfield. The thing about petrol is it will explode, and that's what's happened in 2005. There's always a chance that something could happen. Aircraft fuel has a much lower point of combustion and so is safer. But the combination of the two isn't good. It's worrying, he said.
The next item follows on from that story, and the title is Safety Lessons at Forefront of New Petrol Storage Proposals. And there's an accompanying photograph showing a great plume of smoke, presumably from the 2005 incident. The subheading is Reassurances that Lessons Were Learnt After Buntsfield May Comfort Residents in Light of Plans to Store More Petrol Nearby. From 2018, BP are transforming its Hemel Hempstead depot adjacent to Buntsfield from a mixture of fuels to purely petrol and diesel, and has submitted a planning application to Decorum Borough Council for permission. Residents have raised concerns about the safety of the plans, recalling the huge petrol explosion of 2005. Hertfordshire's Chief Fire Officer, Daryl Keane, said they make sure all safety legislation is complied with and that BP takes the risks seriously. He said regular exercises take place around the county through the Local Resilience Forum and Hearts Resilience. These training events, shaped by our experiences at the Buntsfield explosion in 2005, are designed to test potential responders to an emergency anywhere in Hertfordshire and to ensure that we are well practiced and suitably prepared. The Buntsfield site operators actively and regularly support HFRS and Hearts Resilience training events. Head of Planning and Building Control for St Albans District Council, Tracy Harvey, said, "These safety decisions are led by the Health and Safety Executive, HSE. The Executive provides guidance on what land near such sites should or should not be considered for development and for what types of buildings and uses. Any developments close to the Hemel Hempstead Terminal have abided by the Executive's guidelines," she said. A spokesperson from HSE said it has supported the Major Incident Investigation Board after the Buntsfield 2005 explosion. While recognising the inevitable interest and concern surrounding any planning application since the incident, HSE neither grants permission or gives a final decision. Rather, we diligently execute our role as the statutory consultee giving advice based on safety reasons. Ultimately, however, the decision on the granting of planning permission rests with the planning authority. He stressed that BP need to demonstrate that all necessary preventative measures have been implemented, defined by control of major accidents hazards.
The next article is entitled St Albans Winds Back to 1987 for the 30th anniversary of the Great Storm. Winds of up to 134 miles per hour buffeted the St Albans district 30 years ago this week, wreaking havoc and causing extensive damage in their wake. The Great Storm of October the 15th, 1987, tore across southern England and northern France, and in Herts, power was wiped over the county, schools were closed, and cars, houses and shops were wrecked by winds and debris. Locally, St Albans Council received 158 calls to deal with fallen trees endangering homes or blocking roads. Luckily, nobody was killed or injured in Herts, but the loss of thousands of trees prompted a 10-year free tree scheme to replace them. We asked readers to share their memories of the Great Storm. Zoe said, "My mum was a driving instructor for BSM at the time. We had gone out in her learner's car and a huge tree from the park by the river had fallen across the lower Luton Road. We were driving towards the fallen tree when I realised that mum had forgotten to take the BSM pyramid off the roof. Luckily, we made it under." Claire Naish said, "I remember the school was shut early. I was at Townsend and you could see the huge panes of glass in the canteen shaking." Susan Palmer, who was at Manland School in Parpenden, recalled, "I was getting changed from PE and the roof blew off our classroom. We all had to run out in our pants and vests and amazingly no one got hurt. We were most upset by having to leave the hamster behind as we thought he might die. Fortunately, the hamster survived." Tim Easter said, "I had a hospital appointment at Great Ormond Street to get to, but the overhead power lines were down and it took an absolute age to get there by good old Green Line. I did make it, just." The article is accompanied by the original Herts Advertiser page with the headline, "A Night to Remember."
Well, my piece is about the return to the Victorian age for Harpenden crime author. A prolific Harpenden crime author has released the fifth book in her acclaimed Victorian detective series. Wonders and Wickedness is the latest outing for Detective Inspector Leo Stride and Detective Sergeant Jack Cully, who operate in Victorian London in the 1860s, the favourite time period for creator Carol Hedges. In the novel, which takes its title from a quote in Charles Dickens' novel David Copperfield, a dead body is found in one of the display windows of a London department store, and two parents receive an unexpected letter from their daughter who died in a railway accident 2 years previously. Carol publishes her novels under her own imprint, Little G Books, named after her granddaughter, and the other books in the series are Diamonds and Dust, Honour and a Pay, Death and Dominion, and Rack and Ruin. The series features cameo appearances from famous historical figures, including Dickens and Queen Victoria.
This article states, "Landlords unite to oppose pub business rates hike." The Save St Albans Pubs campaign has presented their petition against business rate increases to Parliament. Landlords, politicians and businessmen met at the St Albans Beer and Cider Festival to discuss the changes to business rates. Campaigner and landlord of the Boot, Sean Hughes, said it was absolutely brilliant. We had a number of landlords down and representatives from St Albans Council and the St Albans Business Improvement District team, who are a cross-section of all the businesses in town. We all know we need to pay rates, but there has to be a fair way of charging it. Earlier this year, St Albans publicans were alerted to a rates increase in the hundreds of thousands after the government revalued business properties. This led to an outcry from both Save St Albans Pubs and the Campaign for Real Ale, or CAMRA. CAMRA representative and festival organiser John Bishop said, "Pubs all over England are being hit by spiralling business rates, and it's great to see landlords in St Albans leading the charge for a fairer deal for our pubs. Without action in November's budget to address the problem, many well-loved community pubs could be forced to close their doors forever. And sending that message to the Chancellor is what our Keep Our Pubs Afloat campaign is all about. More than 500 visitors to the St Albans Beer Festival supported the fight by sending a postcard to their MP. And we call on everyone else who supports the pubs to add their voice online at camera.org.uk/keeppubsafloat. While Cameras and the Save St Albans pub campaigns are separate, both condemn the rates increase, which could mean some pubs having to shift an extra 600,000 pints a year. Sean said, with pubs, the formula being used is so wrong and it needs to concentrate on profit rather than being based on turnover. Because someone selling a drink for a pound might sell a million drinks but only make £10,000 and pay £100,000 in tax. He believes each different model of pub needs a different formula for rates, be they freehold, tenancy or leasehold. It's a challenge, but the government needs to get a hold of it. And the article is accompanied by photographs of the campaign supporters holding up pints and campaign posters and signing an open letter to the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Next, we have an item with the title Anyone for Gin? And there are four accompanying photographs with various people smiling and enjoying the odd tipple. The subtitle is Thousands Flocked to George Street on Friday for Music, Cocktails and Boutique Shopping at the City's First Gin and Jazz Festival. The event was organised by St Albans Business Improvement District and designed to increase footfall to the street and invite new business to the range of boutiques. In just 3 hours, more than 5,000 visitors descended on George Street to explore, shop, eat and drink while listening to live jazz on stage. A range of specialist gins were on offer, from Dillon's and Sucker Punch, stuffed with exotic botanicals and spices. George Street's bars, boutiques and restaurants all contributed to the event, offering complimentary cocktails, special discounts, tastings and more. Street performers entertained the crowds while copious amounts of glitter was provided by local favourite Glitterbox, all set on a newly laid lawn courtesy of Bespoke Flooring. Bid director Sarah Gillow, owner of Gallio Jewellers, said, "The retailers and restaurants here have no hesitation in saying that the event was an overwhelming success. We look forward to welcoming the crowds back in the future, now that they are agreed that George Street is a destination for quality, design and entertainment."
The next article asks the question, is remains of deer further proof that a big cat is prowling across the district? A severed deer foot carcass found by an unsuspecting dog walker may yet be another piece of evidence for the existence of the St Albans big cat. Sue Greenwood was walking her dog in Wheathampstead at about lunchtime on Tuesday, October the 3rd, when she spotted the remains of a single deer foot and lower leg, with stripped bone broken and completely exposed just above the knee joint. She said, "I walk there all the time, and I'm walking around with my dog, and literally it was on the side of the footpath. It was fresh and soft. It can't have been a fox. It was possibly this big cat. What was left there a fox wouldn't have killed and stripped it like that." Although she used to disbelieve reports of a big cat sighting, Sue admits she is now a bit of a believer. "I haven't seen the big cat, but it's hard to believe anything else has done that. I used to be a skeptic, but now I'm not. But it doesn't bother me because I know it won't attack me unless I'm cornered." Adding, "I don't know where the rest of the deer is because that was on its own. There weren't any bits. There was no blood unless it dragged it away." This latest finding is just another piece in the big cat puzzle. Witness reports have been building up over this year, and a taxi driver even managed to snap a highly debated video of the potential beast. Half of a mutilated deer stripped to the spine was found by a different dog walker in April, and in June, large feline paw prints were preserved leading through a golf bunker after the night of rain. In January, two Oaklands College staff members saw a large sandy-coloured cat. Scratch marks were found on a tree after a huge animal was seen near Wellen, and a big black cat was spotted by Luton Airport last year. Reports have come from all around the district, including Wheathampstead, Wellen Garden City, Hatfield, Sandridge and Luton. A Freedom of Information request in November 2016 revealed that Harts Police received about 30 big cat reports in the previous 5 years. They ask sightings are reported on 101 and a safe distance is kept from the animal.
And this piece is Remembering Harts County Council leader Robert Gordon. Tributes have been paid to Harts County Councillor leader Robert Gordon by local MPs and the leader of St Albans Council. Councillor Gordon, who had lived with cancer for some time, died on Friday. He'd been head of the County Council since 2007 and a councillor since 1989, representing Nascot Park, Goughs Oak and Bury Green divisions. Leader of St Albans District Council Alec Campbell said, "It's very sad news. I understand he was suffering from cancer. I'm a fairly recent leader in St Albans, but before I became leader, he was always very happy to spend time with me and explain how things worked and solve problems. And for that, I'm thankful. He was a leader for 10 years in Hertfordshire, and he's going to be difficult to replace. Before becoming leader, Councillor Gordon held the portfolios of children's services, education and resources and performance. He was a member of Watford Borough Council from 1982 to 1990 and again from 2002 to 2006. He was also the first chairman of the Hertfordshire Police Authority between 1995 and 1997 and has served as an NHS non-executive director. Harpenden MP Bim Athalami said, "I'm very sad to hear of the death of Robert Gordon. He was an incredibly important political figure in Hertfordshire, whose kindness and friendship will be missed by so many, as much as his advice and efforts working for the people of this county. My thoughts and prayers are with his family." St Albans MP Anne Main said, "I'm saddened to learn of this news. Robert Gordon was a diligent leader of the council and was always open and helpful when I dealt with him. Robert struck me as someone who was thoughtful, personable and kind and always showed a real willingness to do his best for Hertfordshire. He will be greatly missed by colleagues and my thoughts are with his family and loved ones at this difficult time." Councillor Gordon, who was born and went to school in Hertfordshire, was appointed a CBE in the 2012 Jubilee Honours. He was formerly a Deputy Lieutenant of Hertfordshire and until summer this year was a Governor of the University of Hertfordshire. He is survived by his wife Susie and their three grown-up daughters. And there's a really lovely picture of him smiling.
After that important obituary, here are the names of people who've died since the last edition and whose families have announced their death in this week's Harts Advertiser. Where recorded, their ages are given as well. Stan Bacon, aged 91. Brother Roger Lucian Boss, aged 76. Christine Campbell. Terence Cyril Cox, aged 76. Joshua Luke Faraway, aged only 18. Barbara Hammond, Ella Hyde, aged 87. Michael John Ivory, Patricia Mary Herford, aged 87. Kevin Maloney, Frederick Herbert Olver, aged 91, John Charles Plumstead, John Surridge, and Hilary Tomlinson. We hope that their souls rest in peace, and we send our condolences to all their families. There will now be a short musical interval. Thank you. In this part of the programme, we will read the advertiser's editor's comments, the opinion of an important committee in St Albans, under the heading Opinion, readers' letters and further news items. This is followed by a selection of entertainments in the area during the next 2 weeks, our radio listings, and we now return to the other readers.
So this next piece is a comment from the Hearts Advertiser, and it's entitled Do the Right Thing and Own Up. The scenes of wanton vandalism at Westfield Road Cemetery go beyond youthful hijinks. They were the deliberate desecration of the last resting place of 9 local residents. What would motivate anyone to kick over these memorials? Because this isn't just a case of a few vases being smashed, it's a destruction on a grand scale which obviously took a concerted effort by those responsible. We've reported in the past of thefts from gravestones or the odd bit of graffiti, but it's hard to remember vandalism on this scale in recent years. Stepping up police patrols in the area after the fact is all very well, but those responsible need to be made to pay for their crimes, and we would urge anyone with information to come forward. The same applies to the terrible tragedy in Camp Road last week, in which great-grandmother Barbara Liddell was knocked down and killed by a hit-and-run driver. Surely someone out there knows who was behind this senseless act. Maybe a friend, work colleague or family member has been acting strangely since the incident and put their car in for emergency repairs the following day. No matter how tempting it is to stay silent, imagine how you would feel if you were grieving for a loved one killed in this way and then think about doing the right thing. Because unfortunately, without further information on both of these crimes, the police may not get the results we deserve and those responsible will not be brought to justice.
The next piece, entitled Your Opinions, appears to be from St Albans Civic Society, and the title is Why We Must Not Sleepwalk Into a Rail Freight Nightmare. The threat of a rail freight depot on Greenbelt land on the former airfield near Park Street has been around for over a decade. People have probably become somewhat indifferent about the subject. They have forgotten the huge impact it would have on the local environment, with massive warehouses and hundreds of additional cars and distribution lorries adding to the daily congestion and pollution on the road networks around St Albans. There is also the question of the proposed, up to 12, daily freight liners in and out of the depot, and how they are incorporated into the timetable's reliable operation. Despite repeated questions about this from the Civic Society and MPs Anne Main, St Albans, and Oliver Dowden, Hartsmere, Network Rail has failed to produce details of how and when the necessary infrastructure works would take place to the tracks and tunnels, and moreover which pathways these trains would occupy and how they might affect the often beleaguered Thames Link services. In recent weeks, the Hearts Advertiser has published letters from readers on the subject. Some maintain that more freight is good, and, with various infrastructure works, who pays, everything will work in the end. Others raise questions over the use of the fast lines and even safety. Let's try and clarify. The southern part of the Midland Main Line, MML, is already busy. It will become even busier. Intercity, East Midland Trains, expects to go from 5 to 6 expresses each hour on the fast lines. Thames Link is adding more services in 2018. Luton Airport wants dedicated fast links. Several freight operators already use the slow lines. Pathing and timing a freight train moving continuously along is one thing. It's quite another, and a potential problem, when they have to slow in order to cross over into and out of any depot. The rail freight operation has never proposed using the fast lines. Freight liners would approach from the south on the down slow line, crossing over the up slow track so as to access the depot. Therein lies a possible delay for Thames Link services. Once across, they proceed down and tunnel under all 4 lines and into the depot on the former airfield. Most freight liners will come from ports like Felixstowe, Southampton or Tilbury, but any from the north go on by to Cricklewood run round and approach from the south, as already mentioned. The aggregate trains currently using a siding near Radlett generally operates well. However, they can cause delay, particularly when exiting the depot. St Albans is now very much a commuter city, as are neighbouring towns along the line. A reliable train service is vital for thousands of residents. That is why the Society objects to the rail freight fret. It needs detailed proof it can work. Sleepwalking into its nightmare is unthinkable. We urge people, rail users or not, to oppose the depot and lobby councillors at County Hall not to sell the land for such a use.
Next, we have a letter from Roma Mills, who is Labour District Group Leader from Glenferrie Road in St Albans. The letter is entitled Huge Shortfall in Affordable Homes. In your report of the Council's decision to refuse an application for an affordable housing scheme on October the 5th, you described the local house building target as controversial, quote, with some arguing it's 200 a year, others arguing it's a figure of only 100, end quote. I can confirm that the target for new build affordable housing in St Albans District is 200 properties per year from the 1994 District Local Plan Review. But the council has only managed to deliver 10 in the 6 months to September the 30th, 2017, and a total of 66 in 2016-17. When the target was set, it was acknowledged to be a considerable underestimate of the overall need for affordable housing, which includes council, housing association homes, affordable rented properties, which are at 80% of local market rents, and shared ownership schemes like this recent one. The assessed need is for 335 new affordable homes each year from the Strategic Housing Market Assessment in 2015. And the long history of failing to meet this is leaving more and more local people struggling in adequate and insecure housing. The recent announcement from central government of funding for an extra 5,000 new council houses across the country will do little to address the current shortfall. To get a sense of the scale of the most urgent housing need, there are currently 77,240 families in temporary accommodation across the UK. That figure includes 120,540 children.
This letter is from Giles Summers by email. House prices crisis. Please could you help highlight the following? 1. House prices are high and will remain so while central banks flood systems with money and keep interest rates low. 2. Population growth is a core issue. 3. Reducing buy-to-let via charges would help stop investors pushing prices up. Yes, there would be fewer rental properties, but that would be balanced by fewer rentals, as more would buy instead of landlords doing so. 4. Giving houses to young single mothers, like in Oakland's, does not reduce prices for normal workers and only incentivises poor family planning. 5. Council houses do not need to be in places like St Albans. Why should some pay through the nose to live in this city only to see a council tenant next door getting the place for cheap or free and then a nice bonus of a right to buy? The government needs to drive more jobs up north. 7. We must stop cramming houses into new sites, pay less money when converting greenbelt sites and put fewer houses on. We could have leafy new developments that are nice to drive past and live in rather than the new brick jungles. 8. Build smaller places that are more affordable. Gabriel Square is mainly 800k and £1.3 million houses. I hate the thought of this city being ruined by unfair property plans.
This next letter is from Andy Love from Warren Road of St Albans, and he thinks a better hospital solution is needed. As both a St Albans resident and a known supporter for a new central hospital for West Hearts, I would appreciate the opportunity to respond to Mr Wigley's letter in last week's Hearts Advertiser. In supporting the redevelopment of Watford General Hospital, Mr. Wigley has clearly ignored the difficulties that many St Albans residents face getting to Vicarage Road and then finding a parking space. He says in bracket, it's strange when you consider he is chairman of the St Albans and Harpenden Patient Group. He didn't mention the steep hill from the car park to get to the hospital buildings or that it is right next door to a Premier League football club. Then we come to the redevelopment of the Vicarage Road site. Where was the mention that the new redevelopment will not be completed until 2030 and cause years of disruption and inconvenience? Or that the stages of redevelopment could be delayed or even cancelled depending on the availability of NHS funding? Regarding suitable sites for a new hospital, Mr. Wigley might not be aware of the suitable sites for a new centralised acute services hospital, but that doesn't mean there aren't any. I can think of a few, but I will not mention them because that is not the point of my response to Mr. Wigley's letter. He then mentions about keeping services at St Albans City Hospital. The Hearts Advertiser, who are, in my opinion, very responsible in reporting matters that affect us all, have run stories about wards closing and certain services being moved away from our hospital. My understanding is that despite WHHT's assurances that additional services will be provided in their submitted strategic outline case, or SOC, at St Albans Hospital, these are not set in stone and they can be varied. Let's not kid ourselves, the current St Albans Hospital site will never be anything more than a satellite hospital because someone, in their wisdom, took a decision a long time ago to sell off much of the hospital grounds for housing. St Albans and West Hearts residents in general need to make NHS executives and our West Hearts Hospital Trust aware that we're not satisfied with redeveloping inadequate existing hospital sites. We don't want our hospital services disrupted for years whilst these works go on, and we deserve a better long-term solution to meet the needs of an ever-increasing and ageing population. St Albans and other West Hearts residents should soon have an opportunity to register their support for a new and centralised emergency and specialised care hospital in West Hearts when a new online petition is started.
This letter is from a lady, Mairead Allwell, entitled Something Must Be Done at Junction. I'm writing to yet again bring to councillors' attention the dangerous lack of pedestrian crossings around the King Harry Junction. There are at least 5 schools and nurseries around this area with children on bikes and scooters and parents with buggies trying to cross in both directions on both Watford Road and on Watling Street. There is no safe way to cross. This morning I saw an 11 or 12-year-old boy navigate his way through 2 rows of cars heading into town on the Watford Road, then try to pause on the small halfway point with his bike while waiting for a chance to continue his crossing to head towards Marlborough School. There was no space to keep himself and his bike off the road and drivers were making no allowances for him. I then had to cross in the opposite direction with 2 small children pushing their scooters and myself pushing a buggy, all trying to again squeeze into this tiny middle section before trying to weave through the 2 lanes of aggressive drivers to the steep bank leading up to the footpath on the other side. I first mentioned these concerns 5 years ago, and it is getting worse. Is the council waiting for one of my children to be killed, or another child, or their parent? Elderly people also have to play chicken with motorists to cross the road at the bus stops. Are councillors waiting for the rail freight to be approved, adding even more traffic to the area? Which one of them is going to make the simple and obvious decision to put a pedestrian crossing on the Watford Road and Watling Street near the roundabout? Perhaps the fatality on Camp Road will make the council address the similar issues on that side of town. It is sad that we need to lose a life before action will be taken. A bit of white paint and a couple of flashing yellow lights. Are the school children not worth that? Councillors should forget their long-term plans for this junction. Just send someone out to put in 2 crossings and keep pedestrians safe.
And now back to some news items. The next article is called Hearts 10K Heroes Raise Thousands for Rennie Grove. Friends, families and work colleagues lined up alongside 2,300 runners and walkers taking part in the 12th annual Hearts 10K on Sunday, all raising funds for Rennie Grove Hospice Care. Attracting everyone from elite runners to novices, the fastest finishers started to cross the line in less than 34 minutes. In first place, with an impressive 33 minutes and 40 seconds, was Warwick Rath, who returns to complete the Hart's 10K each year, despite now living in Surrey. Second place, female Tilly Snow, who crossed the finish line at 40 minutes and 42 seconds, said, "It's just so much fun to be part of something like this. The weather is beautiful, everyone is in really good spirits, and it's for a great cause." Work colleagues using the 10K as a team-building opportunity included Sherard Solicitors, gold sponsors Plowman Craven, Understanding Recruitment and Fluxus Fitness. Running clubs were also well represented, including the Harpenden Arrows, who have been supporting the Hart's 10K from the start, together with women-only running club Athena. Others participating on the day were Ron Redbourne, Wheat Hampstead Warriors and I Love PT. Others participating this year included the St Albans Nordic Walking Group, some of whose members had first-hand experience of the care provided by Rennie Grove. Running duo Greg and Tim Hayden from Harpenden and New York, respectively, were sporting Lederhosen t-shirts in a bid to celebrate Oktoberfest while out on the route. Greg said, "I did the 10K last year and invited Tim along to join me for 2017. It's a great event and it's just full of energy." And to prove that age is no barrier to taking part, 83-year-old Andy Bell from St Albans crossed the finish line to claim his third Hart 10K medal and said how much he loves the camaraderie of the event. His daughter, Sue Murphy, also took part on the day. Lawrence Levy, founder of the Hart's 10K, said, "It was another great day for the Hart's 10K and for Rennie Grove Hospice Care."
And this piece is about Golfers Charity Fundraiser, also raising funds for Rennie Grove. Golfers got into the fundraising swing by raising thousands of pounds for Rennie Grove Hospice Care at a recent charity golf day. The event, organised by long-standing supporter and Harpenden resident Mike Hodge, raised an incredible £13,000. Mike and his wife Sarah have now raised around £200,000 for Rennie Grove over the past 15 years from the renowned and popular annual golf days at Aldwickbury Park Golf Club and other events. Mike Peters, managing director of the event's headline sponsor, Jarvis Homes, said, "We support Rennie Grove due to its incredible work in our local community, helping people in their real hour of need. Therefore, once again, we're delighted to have sponsored this fantastic event, raising much-needed funds for Rennie Grove, whilst ensuring everyone on the day thoroughly enjoyed themselves." 27 teams took to the fairway for this year's event, which was followed by evening dinner. Magicians provided mesmerising entertainment during the meal, and a lively auction followed when one of the top lots on the offer was a light aircraft trip from Elstree to the Isle of Wight, including lunch at Bembridge Harbour, donated by Ken Whittaker of Harpenden Estate Agents John Curtis.
This next article features a lovely photograph of a young lady called Emily Hayes and some very delicious looking cakes. A Wheat Hampstead teenager has raised an impressive £750 for Macmillan Cancer Support through her love of baking. Emily Hayes, 14, a student at John Law's School in Harpenden, organised three separate fundraising events to sell her homemade cakes for the charity. The first was for the Third Wheat Hampstead Brownies, where Emily is a young leader, and she also held sales at home and at school. This is the third year running that Emily has raised money for Macmillan's Coffee Morning, but this year's total has beaten the last 2 years put together. Emily said, "I love to bake, so it's an easy and fun way for me to fundraise, and I would like to help people suffering with cancer. I'm extremely proud of how much money we have all raised together. I'm very grateful for everyone's donations, and I can't believe how much money we've managed to raise this year."
The title for this item, School Aid Donation, and it's accompanied by a photograph showing a dozen or so school staff and pupils smiling in front of a vehicle with School Aid sign written on the side. A Harpenden school has decided to donate its maths textbooks to African pupils. After the Cecil Grant Founders Trust organised new books for St George's School, teacher Leah McCarthy decided to donate the old books to School Aid. School Aid provides school books and other educational resources to schools in Africa. They work with non-governmental organisations to ensure the books help pupils learning. With some help from Year 9, a minibus was filled with books and sent on to Tanzania, South Africa, Lesotho and Malawi. Miss McCarthy said the pupils worked like Trojans, packing the stacks of books into boxes donated by Ray Peacock from the small removal company of Harpenden. I really couldn't have done it without them, and I'm delighted the books have gone to such a good cause.
The next article is entitled Charity Sailor Excited to Join Round the World Race. An excited charity sailor is making her final preparations before jetting across the world to crew a racing boat in aid of mental health. London Colney's Shona Davis is embarking on the six-month Clipper Round the World Yacht Race. She will help navigate two legs of the 40,000 nautical mile journey on a 70-foot yacht. She will cruise 5,000 miles from Western to Eastern Australia and then a further 7,000 miles from Australia to Northern China via Vietnam. Shona hopes to raise £20,000 for the adventure, half of which will be donated to Mind in Mid-Hearts. It's a charity close to Shona's heart after it pulled her through a mental breakdown in 2015. She said, "It was hands down the deepest and darkest period of my life thus far. I felt like my life was over when in fact it signalled the beginning of something else, and my Clipper journey is part of me taking charge and healing myself." Shona sets off this Saturday. "I can't even get my head around it. It's all over the place. I'm trying to finish the admin, get packed and shop. It's chaos at the moment, but I'm really happy. It's absolutely exciting. I am going to miss everyone, but I'm going to miss my dog the worst. I'm absolutely desperate to spend time with him at the moment." She added, "I will try to make sure the blogging and the Facebook and the Twitter is up to date so that everybody can see what's going on. There's a tracking website as well, which is the most addictive thing in the world. At the time the Hearts ad went to press, the crew she will be joining were in the lead, and she is optimistic about winning. We are not called Dare to Lead for nothing," she said.
Well, this is the sports section, and it's entitled City Eye Cup Upset as They Prepare for Wood. The glare of the TV cameras and a visit from a rival from a higher division sounds daunting, but St Albans City manager Ian Allinson is relishing the visit of Boreham Wood and believes a magical FA Cup shock could be on the cards. Saints face Wood, who sit 11th in the Vanarama National League in the FA Cup fourth qualifying round, with the winners taking their place in the first round proper. It will be shown live by the BBC, both on their website and via the red button on the TV. And while Allinson, who spent 8 years at Meadow Park, is expecting a tough encounter, he's also aware that this has all the makings of an upset. He said, "I went to watch them last week. On their day, they're very good, but it's a game I'm going to enjoy and relish, and hopefully we can knock them out. It's great to go into a game as the underdogs. We have no pressure on us. They're the team from the National League, and whatever we'll do, we'll look forward to it." Saints prepared for the game with a 2-0 win over Bath City, a victory that lifted them to second in the National League.
And now let's take a look at some of the radio programmes you might like to listen to during the week ahead. This Saturday, October 14th, Radio 3 starts 2 days of broadcasting with the theme of Why Music, the Key to Memory. It's a weekend of events, concerts and discussions broadcast from London's Welcome Collection, exploring music's unique capacity to be remembered. So on Saturday morning on Radio 3 at 11 o'clock, pianist Igor Levit plays Beethoven's Diabelli Variations and talks about how a performer goes about memorising a complex work. Then at 1 o'clock in Saturday Classics, the soprano Leslie Garrett presents music that brings back memories for her. Later on in the day, there's jazz with the memory theme. And at 6:30 in the evening, Beyond Memory, Music in the Moment, looks at the latest research revealing how music enhances the lives of those who live with dementia. The memory theme continues all day on Sunday as well, and that's all to be enjoyed over the weekend on Radio 3. Meanwhile, on Saturday morning, over on Radio 4 Extra, you can indulge memories of a rather different kind, with 3 hours of programmes dedicated to the helpful telephone operators who used to be key to connecting most phone calls by literally plugging you in. That was all over 60 years ago, before the systems became automated. Between 9 and 12 on Saturday morning on Radio 4 Extra, you'll hear plays as well as a documentary recalling the days when the operator had to dial up your call manually in this medley of programmes called Putting You Through Caller. Moving ahead to Sunday evening and switching to Radio 4, Archive on 4 at 8 p.m. ventures on travels in North Korea. Despite the view from the West that North Korea is an impenetrable mystery, visitors still arrive at Pyongyang Airport on business and on holiday. Sarah Jane Hall talks to some of them, including director Dan Gordon, who has made 3 films about the country and whose father has just returned from a walking holiday there.
On to Sunday, October 15th now, and another quick mention of Radio 3's Why Music, the key to memory weekend, because at 10 on Sunday morning, Radio 3 and Radio 6 Music will join forces for a live simulcast when they'll invite the audience to join in a rather fun-sounding game called the Plink Test. It's all about recognising a song from the first half second of the music. Evidently, as well as demonstrating the robustness of musical memory, it can also show your age. It sounds fascinating. Over on Radio 4 at 1:30 p.m, just after The World at 1, a programme called My Father's Israel. It's 50 years since Israel defeated the armies of Egypt, Jordan and Syria in the Six-Day War, a brief conflict with long-lasting consequences. Israel seized the so-called occupied territories in 1967, with strong support from within the country. But there were also dissenting voices, among them Shimon Sabah, who, having voiced his opposition to events and been ostracised as a result, then went into exile in London. In this programme, his son, Rami, visits Tel Aviv to consider this turning point in Israel's history and the price his own family have paid for the stand taken by his father. Then, a little later, at 4:30 p.m. on Radio 4, the writer and poet Bridget Minimore explores how women, and particularly women of colour, have pushed back against the poetry establishment. In Lines of Resistance, she looks at 21st century Peckham and then turns to ancient Iraq, as well as the slave plantations of the Caribbean, in her journey to discover the lines of resistance followed by women throughout history, talking to established writers and teenage poets still struggling to get their voices heard.
From Monday to Friday, there are always some regular features on the radio which you might like to note for your listening this coming week. The Book of the Week, which airs at 10:45 each morning on Radio 4, is How to Be a Champion and features the comedian Sarah Millican as she reads from her autobiography describing the life-changing moment when she discovered her talent for writing and performing comedy in front of an audience of strangers. Over on Radio 3 each day at noon, the composer of the week from Monday to Friday is Puccini, with extracts from his opera Manon. The programme on Monday traces the crafted and dramatic heroines created by Puccini. Then there's Exercise for Your Brain, if you want it, each day at 1:45 on Radio 4, when Sean Williams presents How to Have a Better Brain. On Monday, the boost is exercise. Meanwhile, Classic FM Full Works concerts take listeners on a journey to a different city in the country each evening at 8 p.m. On Monday, the tour starts in Birmingham, with a chance to hear 2 of Birmingham's choirs in action, as well as pianist Lang Lang performing Mendelssohn's first piano concerto, which the composer himself played there in 1840. The tour continues with visits to Glasgow, Liverpool, Manchester and London. Finally, the book at bedtime this week at 10:45 on Radio 4 is Ian Rankin's The Death Watch Journal. This crime serial, by the creator of Inspector Rebus, is set in Edinburgh in 1962 as a prison guard watches over a man sentenced to death for the murder of his wife.
So to round off our selection of radio programmes for the coming week, a few other highlights to note. On Monday, October the 16th, broadcaster and journalist Polly Toynbee examines how war profoundly informed the vision of her grandfather, Arthur J. Toynbee, who rose to become one of the country's most popular historians. Toynbee was a delegate at the 1919 Peace Conference in Versailles. He then became Director of Studies at Chatham House, the Institute for International Affairs, and in 1936 he had an interview with Hitler, which left him pessimistic about the future. Toynbee at War is on Radio 4 at 11 o'clock on Monday morning. Next week, a new theatre opens in London, and for the past year, broadcaster Libby Favs has been following the preparations for the opening of the Bridge Theatre, which will seat 900 people, making it the biggest commercial theatre to open the capital for almost a century. You can hear all about this new venture, which is the brainchild of the former manager of the National Theatre, Nicholas Heitner, and his colleague, Nick Starr, in Planks and Passion, which will be broadcast on Radio 4 on Tuesday, October the 17th at 11:30 in the morning. Also on Tuesday, a must for all fans of Bruce Springsteen, Long Walk Home starts at 10 p.m. on Radio 2 and showcases the work of the rock superstar. At 68, he has 18 albums to his name and millions of fans around the world and in the UK. In this two-part documentary, Bruce Springsteen looks back over the glory days and the musicians who influenced him. Expect a treat of stars as well as Springsteen, and part two follows on Tuesday evening on Radio 2. Then on Wednesday, October the 18th, a new series starts on Radio 4 at 6:30 in the evening. It's called Andy Hamilton Sort of Remembers and features one of the radio comedy's most prolific voices, Andy Hamilton. He's the genius behind such TV series as Outnumbered, but this is the first time he's had his own radio series, and it promises to be a real gem of memories and observations. In the opening programme on Wednesday, he looks at childhood and a formative experience for him when he had his thumb amputated at the age of 5. It proved a useful tool in warding off bullies at primary school, evidently. Andy Hamilton Sort of Remembers on Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4. Enjoy.
Here are the entertainments that are available locally during the next 2 weeks, and there's a large number of them. At the Abbey Theatre, you could attend the final Company of Ten performance of a modern variant of Shakespeare's classic entitled Juliet and Her Romeo, in which the romance is between two people of mature years who are residents in a home. For further information and tickets, phone 01727 857 861. 01727 857 861. At the Auburn Arena, there are a variety of entertainments. Next Saturday, that's this week, at 8 p.m, there's a show called Content Provider by comedian Stuart Lee. On next Tuesday, the 17th of October at 7:30, you could listen to a wonderful rhythm and blues concert sung by Alexandra O'Neill, entitled 30 Years of Hearsay. On Wednesday, 18th of October, this is all at the Auburn Arena, the political comedian Matt Ford, who's appeared at the Royal Variety Performance, presents a highly topical, amusing show. And on Thursday the 19th of October at 7:30 p.m, there's a special BBC big band show with the singer Claire Martin celebrating the 100th anniversary of the birth of Ella Fitzgerald. All these entertainments are on at the Auburn Arena, whose box office number is 01727 8 4 4 8 8. 01727 8 4 4 8 8. At the Maltings Theatre in St Albans on Friday and Saturday, 20th and 21st of October at 8 p.m. There's an evening of popular opera performed by the St. Albans Chamber Opera entitled A Tour of Europe, with music by Puccini, Verdi, Mozart, Bizet, Handel and Strauss. For information and booking of tickets, phone 0333 666 666, 0333 666 666. At the Cathedral, St Albans Cathedral, this Saturday at 7:30, there's a concert by the St Albans Symphony Orchestra of many favourite popular excerpts, for example, from Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture and Borodin's Polotsian Dances. For further details and seats, phone 01727 890 2100. That is 01727 890 2100. At St John's Church, St Albans, on Saturday week, the 21st of October at 7:30 p.m, there is a carillon chamber concert of music by Mendelssohn, William Byrd, Ralph Vaughan Williams, John Taverner, Hubert Parry and Bach. And at another church in St Albans, St Peter's Church, St Albans, at 1 o'clock next Wednesday, the 18th of September, there's a recital by a Dutch violinist and a pianist born in Luxembourg. It is, as usual, free, but there will be a collection in support of Rennie Grove Hospice. The following entertainments are at the Harpenden Public Halls. This Saturday, on the 14th of October, at 8 p.m, the legendary British comedian Simon Dawson could amuse you. Next Wednesday, the 18th of October, you can listen to an evening of earth-shattering blues music played mainly by the guitarist Walter Trout and supported by others. On Thursday of next week, the 19th of October, you can hear Jason Donovan talking and singing about the highs and lows of his life. Tickets for those three events obtained on 01582 767 525. 01582 767 525. We have now come to the end of this recording, and so from Alison, Jenny, Kate and Michael, in no particular order, and from Jenny and Mickey, from Fiona and Danny, farewell. Here's to the next time. Goodbye.